Okay. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Okay. So what I'd like to explain is a chazal that Rashi mentions on Kehelis, and has to do with Bereshis. I mean, I'd like to show where exactly Kehelis fits in. Of course, Kehelis does have to do with Shivas Yemei Bereshis. So Rashi says, Havela Vola Mama Kehelis. So Rashi says, Kehelis, it's on Pasuk Beis. Kehelis Kore Tagor. Va'omer Al Kol Yitziras Shivas Yemei Bereshis. Sha'akol Havel Shalav Olamo. So, I mean, the question is, I mean, what does it have to do with Shivas Yemei Bereshis? I mean, Havel all of Kehelis really has to do with the personal life of man. And the essence of Kehelis is to show that there really is nothing that a person can do to find psychological happiness. Psychological happiness, what a person is looking for in the psychological is not possible. And the we'll get it a little more exactly, but basically that's the whole Sefer Kehelis, is to show that man is, it's a havel shel avolim, because it means that the person is engaged in striving, endless striving, and all his energies are placed, all the psychological energies are invested, and heavily invested, and it's invested in nothing, and something that doesn't exist, a complete fantasy. So he that's really the Sefer, and the Sefer shows in every possible way how that outcome is, that a person is looking he's looking for something, and basically the reality wipes it all out. I mean, reality wipes it all out. You could say that in Kehelis Gimel, for instance, where he talks about Kimikre, Pasuk Yates, Kimikre v'nei Adam Mikra Behemo, Mikra Echad Lahem, Kmoze Kein Moze, Ruach Echad Lakol, Mosar Adam and Abehemo Oyin Ki Akol Havel, Akol Holech HaMokam Echad, Akol Hayim Afa V'Akol Shevel Afa, Miyodeya ruach b'nei odom ha'olei l'mola v'ruach ha'behima eredesi l'mata l'oretz. So he means to say that basically what a person is striving for is something that he can feel, that he has something, and he has nothing. As a matter of fact, even the greatest chacham mikra odom mikra b'hima, and then he mentions many times that the lamo chachamti oz yoser, even the greatest chacham, the end is misa, and misa basically wipes everything out. So he can't have any satisfaction or any feeling that he has something which he's striving for, is simply unattainable. It's not reality. He works and he puts his energies into it because of a certain fantasy and illusion of success. But in reality, it's non-existent, and a part of him always knows that, and therefore he's never could really be happy, because his mind always, like Dibenezer says, Hamavis bein einav tamid. So this is essentially the system is set up where basically his striving, the end goal. So everything that he's striving for is non-existent, and his mind is aware of that. So and he says, and don't tell me about Olam Haba, because he says Mi yodea ruach b'nei adam olei l'molav ruach b'nei redesi l'mata l'aretz, which basically means that Olam Haba, the true idea of Olam Haba, is something that requires great knowledge. And it's not something which is psychologically satisfying. It is a mistake that people make, that what they do is that they tell themselves that it's all worth it for Olam Haba. But the Olam Haba that is a reality, the Miyodea, is not the thing that the emotions are looking for. And so he cryptically, he doesn't want to reveal. I mean, Kehelis is very hidden. The way he has double entendres, you don't know what he means. Gamze Hevel, you don't know whether he means the statement or the thing. Very hidden the way he wrote it. But basically what he's saying is that the Olam Haba of fantasy that the emotions are striving for is non-existent. The real Olam Haba is true, it exists. But that is not something which is satisfying to the drive, for the drive of man. The drive of man is the Olam Haba that is satisfying for the drive of man is the Olam Haba of the Umos Olam. The prototype is the happy hunting grounds. I mean, that concept of Olam Haba, which most people are attached to in some modified form, is basically the thing which is satisfying for man on a psychological plane. But in reality, that doesn't exist either. That's just a total fantasy. The Olam Haba that does exist, the Mi Yodea, is that Nefesh Adam Oli Lamalo and Nefesh Behema Ayeretzi Lamata Loretz, that one, it's true, it exists, but if a person has knowledge of it, if he's a Yodea, he knows that that is not satisfying the urge that propels him through life to have something. It's a completely different phenomenon. So that's why it concludes, V'risi ki ein tov me'ashe yismach odom b'masav ki hu chalko, that happiness is only possible in an activity in this life. But the only thing that is, the thing that is closest, that brings man closest to psychological happiness, is happiness which is, which involves an activity, the activity itself, but not the having. The having and the possessing and the feeling that a person really is looking for, that I have something, I've achieved something, there is something here, that is a complete illusion, and he could never enjoy it, and so far as he's intelligent, he knows that it's completely mythical. So that's why he says, V'risi ki ein tov me'ashe yismach odom b'masov, ki hu chalko. The acts themselves, that's the only chelik he has. Ki mi yivienu liros b'mesh yiyeh acharov. Because he's going to die, and once he dies, whatever he has no control over. And since he has no control over it, even in the fantasy that he would be able to enjoy it, were it something real, he doesn't even have that. You see, because the mind of a person is so strange that he looks for a kind of immortality, and he's attracted to immortality with such a great force that even though he knows he can't enjoy it, he still will strive for it. That's why man strives to build buildings, to have his name on buildings, to be a part of history, which is something which he never can enjoy. But the force of the desire to have something eternal is so powerful that he's attracted to it, even though he knows he can never enjoy it. But even that, he says, even that fantasy can't really, even as a fantasy, it's not even complete. Because he knows, even in the fantasy, mi yivien liros, mashiachrav, it's something which he has no control over. So even as a fantasy, as a hevel in itself, but even in its own framework of Hevel, it is not even something that he can entertain in any intelligent way. So basically, he's doomed in terms of that, that kind of a desire for success or happiness about the self. So the whole Sefer Kehelis is basically, that's basically what it is. So the question is, I mean, if that's the case, so what does it mean that he's Kore Tag al Shivasi Mei Breshis? What's got to do Shivasi Mei Breshis? It has to do basically with psychology. Yeah. Kore Tag of Oma Kol Yitzira Shivasi Mei Breshis Shakol Havel Shel Avol Amer. So that's the question. But we'll get back to that. But anyways, what I wanted to say is, where does Kehelis enter? And where does Kehelis enter? Basically, Kehelis enters in Yetziras HaOdom, but Yetziras HaOdom really after the fall of Adam, after his fall. And before his fall, Kehelis is not talking about the enjoyment of Chachmah. Jan de Chachma is something which he's not discussing. And that's why Chazal say that Mayisr Lodom Cholom Lashi Amal Tachas Hashemesh, Tmuras HaTorah, Sheikru Yor, Shenemar HaTorah Or, Kol Amal Shil Machlith Bo, Es Esek HaTorah Masachar Bo. So he's not talking about a kind of individual that's engaged constantly in Chachmas Hashem. That's not his, insofar as man's engaged in Chachmas Hashem, that's not his, he's not discussing that. He's discussing the psychological energies of man. So that's basically the area of Kehelis. So the question is, what does that have to do with Shivas Nei Breishis? That's the question. But where does Kehelis enter? Kehelis really enters, his entry into Sefer Breishis, into Parshas Breishis, is really after the fall of Adam. See, after the fall of Adam. And after the fall of Adam, the way the Torah describes the fall of Adam is interesting, because the Torah says like this, that after his fall, once he gave in to the lure of the Eitz HaDaas, and that changed his psychological orientation, his energies then became fixed in the lust of Taiva, so on all levels, basically. So then it says that that he realized a new institution was created in him, which was a sense of worthlessness and shame, and he realized that he was naked, which was the conscience, the entity of conscience, what we call conscience. You know, what the psychologists define as the superego is the thing that came into, became a part of his nature. But interesting is that what happened, it says, Vayishmu eskola Hashem Elokim mesalech bagol in roch hayom, Vayishchabe yodam vishnu ne'er Hashem Elokim besoch etzagon. Next pasuk says, Vayikra Hashem Elokim alo adam, Vayom alo ayeka. So he answered Vayomar, and he answered as Kol Choshamati Bagon, Vayiro Ki Eira Manochi Vayichave. So Adam Arishon answered the question. He said, "I realized that I was hiding because I realized I'm naked, and it's not roy, it's not appropriate. Once he had that sense, it's not appropriate to stand before the Shechina without any clothing." So Kadosh Baruch Hu answered him, "Vayim mi yigid l'cha ki eramata." I mean, Eitzah shetziv yisichol levilti achom menu acholta. So he was caught. He was caught by the question of Kadosh Baruch Hu. So of course, Adam Arishon was a tremendous chacham, as a great chacham. As a matter of fact, when it says about Shlomo HaMelech and Malachim Aleph, so it says that he was vayechkam mikol Adam me'esun ha'ezrachi. That's in Malachim Aleph. And hey, pasuk yiralef. Vayechka mikol ha'adam me'esun ha'ezrachi v'heimon v'chalko v'dardar b'nei mocho v'yishma b'chol ha'goyim soviv. So the Medrash says, mikol ha'adam ze adam rishon, me'esun ha'ezrachi ze Avram, heimon ze Moshe, v'chalko ze Yosef, v'dardar ze dar midbar. So the first one that I mentioned is Adam Rishon. So Adam Rishon was really a chacham. Was from the greatest chachamim that ever existed. So the question is, I mean, if he was such a great chacham, how did he get trapped by that answer? I mean, the moment he said that va'ira, he had one mitzvah, and the mitzvah was not to eat from the Eitz HaDaas. So then he ate from the Eitz HaDaas, and he realized that he was naked. So he realized he was naked. It's not right to be amud b'fnei Hashchina that way, because that new sense came into him. So then when HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked him, where are you, Ayeka, he says, "Is Kol Choshmati Bagan V'Yirgayim V'Kerem Anach V'Yachaveh." So then he was caught immediately. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, "Mi Yigid L'cha Kerem Atah." So he was such a great chacham. So how is it possible that he fell into that trap? I mean, it seems like a rather simple trap. The moment you say that, he gives the answer that he realized that he had a new... Something happened to him. He had a new sense because At first it says that he walked in the gun and he was fine. The Yishnei Rum Adam Ishtav Alayas by Shafir. So he should have realized that that's not a good answer. He's going to get trapped. Yeah, so what is the answer to that question? The answer to that question is basically that the new, you see, before the chait, he was able to look at himself and to study himself just like he could study anything in the creation. The self was another object of study, just like anything else. So that's why he started to study the different animals, and he saw everyone has a zivug, and he himself saw that he was lacking. He was studying himself. He was able to study himself as an object. But the moment he was a chote, and this sense of conscience entered, a new sense about the self. This isn't turned conscious, but basically it's a new sense about the self. The sense about the self was so overpowering that all his energies, that became the repository of all his energies. So the moment that became the repository of all his energies, he could only be concerned about that self and his reaction to events that took place with regard to the self. The self became the center. All the energies were centered in the self. So if something happened with regard to the self, that absorbed all the energies. Once that absorbed all the energies, the logical analysis of the self became completely obsolete. It was unable to do it. So when he heard the call at Hashem Elokim, Mishalech Bagon L'Ruach Hayom, and he sensed that sense of busha, the shame was overpowering, and that there was no energy left for him to think logically about himself before, and now he changed, and how could he give this answer? Because this answer is he's going to be trapped, because he's going to be revealing, in essence, the thing that he's most afraid of revealing, namely that he was a chote, because that was the real sense of shame and nakedness, like Chazal say, Rashi said, was he had one mitzvah, then it's atlan in that. So he fell into the trap of admitting unwillingly, he fell into the trap of admitting that he was basically a chote. And he was unable to avoid it. With all his intelligence, he was unable to avoid it because he was completely overcome by the energies that were completely wrapped up in the sense of self and his reaction to the Kol Hashem Elokim Mishalech Bagon L'Ruach Hayom. That reaction was the Kol Hashem Elokim Mishalech Bagon L'Ruach Hayom was a perception. As I mentioned before, it wasn't an intellectual perception. It was a different kind of perception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It was now tainted because it became something which was translated into a psychological kind of a phenomenon. A phenomenon that was tied with his sense of worthlessness and his preoccupation with the self. And all the energies were wrapped up in that preoccupation. Once they became wrapped up in that preoccupation, he couldn't see logically that his answer is a trap, because logically, how did he know this? But the preoccupation with the sense of self and the curlet and his reaction to the curlet of Shem Elokim Mishalech Bagon, the Ruach Hayim, was something that completely absorbed all his psychological energies. And there was nothing left. And even though he was the greatest chacham, he simply could not avoid it. So he fell into the logical trap. But the whole world came under a completely different way of looking at things, and that to this day is really the lemur from this is basically that the most difficult thing for man to do is to look at himself and to study himself in an objective way. I mean, that's his downfall. You see, with regard to the tithes that have to do with something outside the self, those are much more controllable because the sense of self protects him or alerts him to those kind of errors. But when it comes to a study of the self, the individual, the person himself, that is completely blocked. In that area, since that's the repository of all the energies, it becomes almost impossible, and all the chokhmah is lost, and the ability to study the self objectively becomes the most difficult thing for man to do. And in order for man to really rise to a qualitatively differentiated level of existence, that's something he must accomplish. He must accomplish. But after the Chet of Adam, that became the most difficult thing. And the Torah is showing you this concept, this idea, in Adam himself, who was the greatest Chacham, but nevertheless, he fell into the very trap he was trying to avoid because he was ashamed of the fact that it was a chote. And in his very first remarks, he admitted that he was the greatest chote, and unwillingly admitted because he was lost in his feelings about his own self worthiness and worthlessness. His worthiness and his worthlessness became the preoccupation of his whole existence. What is he? And therefore, since that event, that is the greatest challenge for man, the most difficult thing for man to do. He has no institution that can help him over there. There's no institution that can help him over there. As a matter of fact, the institution that he has, which is his conscience, will prevent him from seeing himself in an objective light, because then it'll make him see that he is worthless, his worthlessness. And that's something that conscience tries to avoid. That's exactly what conscience tries to avoid, to give a person the sense of worthlessness. So his preoccupation is always to try to make himself feel worthy. And in trying to make himself feel worthy, he's completely blinded to flaws in his character that really make him worthless. The real, true flaws he's blinded from. And that basically is the limud in the parsha. That Adam Rishon, with his great chachma, the chachma can't protect him over here. Chachma over here is simply a tool which does not work, because the energies are completely wrapped up in the need for self-importance. That need for self-importance and the fear of worthlessness is the thing that is precisely the thing that blinds him from any kind of logical analysis of the self. And the Torah shows you this in the instance of Adam Rishon. But what happened over here is that the Adam was changed not only in quality, but in quantity, in terms of how much energy is wrapped up in this sense, which is constantly striving for a feeling of worthiness, for a feeling of a good feeling that he's comfortable with himself. That he's a worthy individual, that he has self-importance. His need for self-importance will always reassert itself. and in many different ways, send out different kinds, various different ways of establishing his sense of self-importance. But the Kehelis really, and that I think is the answer to the question. You see, the Shivas Yimei Bereishis. Why is it say he's Kore Tagal Shivas Yimei Bereishis? Because Shivas Yimei Bereishis has nothing, what does that have to do with Bria Shemayim V'aretz? What does that have to do with Yirakia B'sach HaMayim? But Rashi is really quoting this from a Medrash. And the Medrash is a Medrash and Medrash Rabbah. Medrash says, Yabudu Reb Simon Omar, Shiva HaVolam Omar Kehelas, Keneged Shiva Yimei Bereishis. So it goes through each day. But essentially, what the psukim on each day say is that it will all be eventually be destroyed. Barishon Ksiv, Bereishis Bo Lekim Asa Shemayim Vesoretz. Uksiv Ki Shemayim Ka'oshan Nimlechu, Boretz Ke Beget Tivlet. And Bisheni Yirakia, and then it says the Niglu Kisefer Hashemayim, and Bishlishi Yikov Amayim, and then it says Vechrim Hashem Es Lishon Yam Mitzrayim. Yimaro Suksiv Chofra Lavona Vosha Chama. Each one, he shows the destruction that it's not going to stand laolam. So what does it mean? He's Kori Tagor. I mean, he has no right to talk against the Shivas Yimei Bereishis. I mean, that's the question, really. What does that have to do with Shivas Yimei Bereishis, and what right does he have to make a judgment on Shivas Yimei Bereishis? That's for God to make a judgment on. God, Pasuk says, V'yalkim kitov. But the answer is a strange answer. The answer is that what Kehelis is saying is that man is so wrapped up and the need for self-accomplishment and the concept of accomplishment and finding something and feeling that he has something, that he can't view anything as being of value if he knows that it's going to be destroyed. It's not going to exist forever, you see. And that's really what that medrash, because that medrash holds that it's a question whether the universe is eternal, it will exist eternally, not eternal in terms of being essentially eternal, that it's a creation, gracious world of chemistry, Shemayim Vazoras. But the question is that once there was a creation, will it be God's will to sustain it eternally or not? This medrash holds not. So modern-day cosmology seems to agree with this medrash, that eventually, when we study the universe, we find that eventually everything will dissipate, and ultimately everything will become a uniform sea of energy. So if that's the case, so everything ultimately will disintegrate and be nothing. So that's the way modern-day cosmology agrees with this medrash. But it's interesting that the cosmologist himself, and as I was reading the cosmologist that was discussing this point, couldn't help but enter the sadness of that thought that eventually everything will be nothing. And it bothered him. It bothered him. So what is there? So eventually, if that's true, the whole universe eventually will turn into nothingness. So this planet will be gone, and the sun will reach a point where it burns up everything in its proximity, including Earth, and everything ultimately will become dissipated and become a uniform sea of energy. If that's the case, He lamented over this fact, you know, that then there's nothing for man here. So it shows you an interesting thing. It shows you that what happened to Adam HaRishon after the Chait is something so powerful, so significant psychologically, that even the universe itself, which has nothing to do with him on a personal level, after all, I mean, we're talking about millions and millions of years, millions and millions of years until this happened. But nevertheless, an individual that sees in his mind that this will happen, and even though it's not negaya him personally at all, will feel a sense of remorse about it, because he's so rooted in the emotional need for something that even though he knows he can't have any part in it on a personal level, which would seem to remove any kind of reason for emotional sadness. After all, I mean, sadness and happiness should be based upon the organism. The organism is the only thing that's real on a personal level. That's what the Kabbalah says. I mean, on a personal level, that's the only thing that's real psychologically is the existing organism. And this organism, no matter what you're going to say, is not going to be in existence at the time when the universe destructs. So what does he care? It's not going to affect him or his children or his children's children, great-great-grandchildren. It will never affect him. But the fact that ultimately it is doomed is enough to turn him off on the whole creation. It colors his whole vision of the creation, and he can't find any satisfaction in viewing the creation. It's an interesting thing, but as I was reading this, as I said, this cosmologist was talking about the, you know, what science knows today about cosmology, and how it appears from the study of the universe as we know it today. It does appear that eventually everything will be destroyed, because things are moving, the galaxies are moving apart, and they have either one of two possibilities. Either everything just moves apart and dissipates, or else there's enough gravitational pull to bring everything back to an initial point. But then everything will be destroyed, there will be no remnant of anything either. Either way the cosmologists look at it, what we know of the universe, what we have, will be no record of, no trace even of it, not even a trace of anything. So that's really the pasuk. That's the pasuk. That kaheles kare tagar al shivas yemei bereishis shakol havol shel avolamot. What does it mean? It means to say that he shows that this element in man, the element in man that is in search and in need of finding something of substance, so that he could reflect and think that he has something, that there's something here, you see, that need that man has will affect how he looks at the shivas and bereishis. And since Adam Arishim was a chote, his view of bereishis has become colored, and he can't even enjoy the universe, and he can't even enjoy his own existence, because he knows ultimately, in a time which is so far removed from his senses and his psyche and his satisfactions, doesn't make any difference. But he's Kore Tagar, Al Shivas Yemei Bereishis, and the entire universe makes him sad, because he knows that ultimately it's going to be nothing. What kind of sense does it make? But it means what he's showing you, basically, Kehelis is showing you, how much of the energy of man is absorbed in this element of his nature, in this institution that man acquired in the Chet of Adam, during the Chet of Adam Arishon, the institution which is, you call, whatever you call it, conscience, superego, whatever it is, the need for self-worth. That the preoccupation with the self and the need for a sense of self-worth is so powerful that it'll go beyond the rational, which would mean that a person, like what Chazal say, that a person logically only is concerned about Benini Lenechti, his children, his grandchildren, a certain amount of Doros, that there's a limit to how much emotion a person can attach to his offspring and to a sense of immortality through his offspring. That's true, but it is still so powerful that it even bothers him that the whole creation eventually will be undone. And he can't escape it. He can't escape that feeling, which shows you basically how irrational the structure of the psyche is. And no matter how well a person is psychologically, he still cannot avoid that sense of worthlessness and regard to himself, but even with regard, he must pass judgment on the universe. That's how far-fetched the energy is driven. That he must pass judgment and be sad about the fact that the universe ultimately will cease to exist. So that's really, I believe, the meaning of the Rashi. Kore taga v'omar kore tziyosir z'mebreshi shakol hevel shalom. Doesn't mean that he's judging. I mean, that's ridiculous. And to judge, he's not the creator. How can he judge? He can't judge that. But he knows he can't judge it. But he's showing that the whole Sefer is about how man's mind, his psyche, is so colored because of the nature of the way the investments of his energies have been changed from the time of the Chet of Adam Arishon, that it's virtually impossible to escape, and everywhere as he looks, it's tainted. And if he's looking at the distant universe, which is millions of years beyond his existence, he's going to feel sad because he knows that ultimately everything of humanity is going to be destroyed. So what does it make? He probably won't even be remembered after a short, very short period of time, maybe 100 years. How many people do you know from 100 years ago? So what does he care? But it bothers him. He's Kori Tagar, Al-Shivas and Mebracious. Because it has to bother him, because that institution is so irrational, it colors everything he sees. And in everything he sees, he looks for that something, that there should be something of permanence. It would give him satisfaction if there's something of permanence, even though it has nothing to do with himself and wouldn't give him a trace of satisfaction psychologically. But the idea that there is at least something, somewhere, is it. But the fact that the universe will ultimately destruct, and that's how that medrash holds, so that causes him grief and sorrow, and makes him sad. He's kori tagar. He has to be a kori tagar. Adam has to be a kori tagar, al shivas and mebreshis. That's, I believe, basically what Rashi is Rashi's quoting that medrash, because that medrash really gives you insight into the extent. In Kehelis, it's not just the quality, but in Kehelis, it's the quantity of energy that's the problem. He can't escape because there are things that are good. Like he says, that ain't tov ba'adam, it sounds like at one point he's saying it's not so bad. Reisi can't tov ba'adam kashi yismachadam amasov, ki hu chalko. So it's good. Yeah, but the problem is, yes, because it is true. Ain't tov ba'adam mashi yismachadam amasov. That happens to be true. It's wonderful, but it's not going to do the trick, because the amount of energy that the individual is looking for and his need for a sense of self-worth is something here is so great that Masov is not going to do the trick. Yeah, he's happy at the moment. He's happy, but that's not going to satisfy his need. It's not just the quality that Kallus is about it. It's the quantity. Interesting is that, I mean, that's why Kehelis mentions the big problem is Misa. Misa is the big problem. But the Eif Yamas HaChocham HaMachseel and Yisra'an Kol HaLech HaMakam Echad, he mentioned that several times, that this is something which is Misa, is, of course, the biggest undoing of any kind of sense of self-worth. And no doubt that's why the Torah says, Kibyam HaChocham Menemos Tomos. The Misa was created, Misa, by Hashem Kitov, Zayama Misa. Misa was created because without Misa, that's the price that man had to pay for his chait. The moment he had that chait, now all the energies go into the need for self-worth, for a sense of accomplishment. That need is something which would preoccupy man, and he simply would never be able to remove himself from chait. It would be impossible. There would be no chance for the bechira to work. It would be virtually impossible. But the antidote is Misa. Misa is the only thing which is needed. That's the antidote. Misa gives a person a chance for the bechira to work, because it is a quiet voice inside him that tells him that all his strivings are craziness, basically. It's that word that Mises, the thing that, that tells him that. And Eich Yamas HaChochem HaMaksiel. No matter what, he's, that's what David HaMelech says in Tehillim Mem Tes. That the where he talks about so that's one of the first things he says over there. So of course Chazal distinguish Chacham Yamusu, but Chsil Vayavedu. This is a Nisan and a Neva. The Chsil is totally Neva, but the Chacham dies. But nevertheless, that Kiyira Chacham Yamusu, Yachak Sil Vayavedu, Vazul Acherim Chelam, Kirba Batem Aliolam, Mishkinosim Ador Dor. So that's really the antidote. I mean, that's the that's from that fact that it's inescapable, and no matter what lifestyle a person chooses, ultimately it's Nisa is the end. That, that gives him the chance for Bechira. Without that's Kibyam HaChochem Menemos Tomos. Without Nisa, he wouldn't have a chance once all the energies become wrapped up in the need for self-importance, the need for self-importance. So Mesa really was something which was a introduced Vayarshem Kitov as a Yom Mesa. It was it became a bracha in an unfortunate way because he was a chote. There had to be an antidote to the institution that came in existence because of the chay. But interestingly enough, it seems it wasn't enough. Because if that were enough, so then why do you have to have Kibam Chochman and Mos Tomos? One would think that okay, so Mos Tomos, and now you have the refuah for the taiva is the institution and the need for self importance, which alerts man on with regard to certain kind of averis. It alerts him, but then it itself turns on itself. And he can become preoccupied with that need of self-importance. So the Yom HaMisa counteracts that. The Misa is something which is inescapable and places him into reality so that he can exercise his Bechira once more. But the, yeah, and that, by the way, is where Kehelis comes from, of course. Kehelis is on Odom after the Chet, not Odom Kodom Chet, Odom after the Chet. And that's really the entry point of Kehelis. But it's interesting that it seems to the Torah that that wasn't enough. Because if that were enough, you wouldn't have to have the klola for Adam and the klola for the Isha. It's interesting. The klola for Adam and the klola for the Isha. Because one, he said, okay, that's it. Now he's a subject to Misa. But apparently that's not enough. What else is there? What else there is the two klolos. And by Odom, by the Isha, Harbo Arba Etzvonech Veironech Be'etzav Tel Divonim, Ve'lishech Shukosech Liyim Shobach, and into Odom, Kishamato Lekol Eshtecha, Batocho Min Ha'etz, Asher Tzivzichol Nosoch Min Ha'etz, Aru Odom Bavurecha, Bitzavon Tochalona, Kol Yimei Chayecha. It's an interesting thing. But there's one common denominator here that exists in both the Isha and in the Adam. But it's in two different frames of reference. One is insofar as Leda is concerned, and one is insofar as man being productive in his work. Aru Adam Bavarecha B'Yitzavon Tachalana Kol Yimei Chayecha. You say, what is the one common denominator? And it's in Lashna Mikra. Itzavon. You have the same word. Harbo arba itzvonech veironech be'etzev tel divonim. And by Adam, the same thing. Aru Adam bavarecha be'itzavon tochalena kol yimei chayecha. See, that one thing is common in both. What is itzavon? Itzavon really means depression. That's what it means. It's not tsar. It doesn't say betzar tel divonim. Harbo arbe tzarech. No, it's vonech. The etzev tel divanim. Etzev means a depression. And the same thing by Adam. That aru Adam avarecha be'itzavon tochalena kol yimei chayecha. It means that the term means is that with the two instinctual drives of man, and it differentiates between the drive of man and the drive of the woman, that in the woman it's in the maternal and the productive in having children, having offspring, that's where her instinctual drives are greatest. And with man, it's in the drive to accomplish and be productive, agriculturally or whatever the society may be. Basically, it's agricultural, but as society develops, it goes into different spheres, but it's the same thing. But it means that there's a concomitant current of depression that accompanies both of these instinctual gratifications. It's an interesting thing. I mean, that's basically what the Torah is saying. That apparently the Yom HaMisa is one thing. The Yom HaMisa does offset the fantasy of immortality. But and if the fantasy of immortality were rampant, then he would never be able to avoid chet. That would be his complete preoccupation. So that's true. That is true on an intellectual plane. On an intellectual plane, the Yom HaMisa counters any kind of intellectual. That's what the Shlomo Melech says, that Yosef Das, Yosef Machov. Because the more Das he has, so the more the realization, the more it's real. The more it's real, so the more Machov he has, the more pain he has. So that's true. But apparently that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough. Apparently, the instincts can ride, and in spite of the fact of the Yom HaMisa. So there was something necessary to emotionally attack him. It's a side kind of a thing, an emotional thing. Now, what is the emotional thing? The emotional thing is depression. It's an interesting thing that it was necessary in order for Adam to be placed in a position where he is capable of seeing through the illusions of the institution that was created in order to save him from other kinds of chatayim. What was necessary was that there should be he should have an accompanying current of depression in his accomplishments. By the Isha, it's a depression after childbirth, and that's true psychologically. But that a woman has a certain kind of a postpartum, it's called. But that's really what the Torah is talking about. That depression, an emotional depression, which is the source, is not even something that the person is aware of. It's from the part of the human mind that he's not conscious of. And that depression, for instance, in the postpartum depression, it's something which just strikes a woman, and she feels a sense of worthlessness and depression. And the same thing is true by Adam. Be'itzavon tochalena kol yimei chayecha. That with his accomplishments, there is something unexpected happens. And with his accomplishment, he suddenly starts feeling a sense of depression. So the emotional, apparently what the Torah is describing is that the institution that Adam had recourse to, which was created in Adam to protect him from the lusty tithes, the institution of that protects him from pure lust, which is the institution of the conscience, you see, is one which is based upon a powerful fantasy of immortality, which is counteracted on two levels. It's counteracted on the intellectual level with the recognition of his own demise and the temporality of his own existence. That's an intellectual affront to his sense of self-importance, you see. But apparently that wasn't enough. Apparently there's something else was necessary. And that something else was an emotional phenomenon, that an emotional phenomenon of depression, an undercurrent of depression, which emerges at certain points in a person's life, usually at the points, that's a third, at the points of when he reaches, he reaches his so-called goal, whatever goal he may establish for himself. When he reaches that so-called goal, suddenly he's hit by a depression. He eats and he's successful, he attains his goal, but with that goal is a some kind of an inexplicable depression that he never unexpected. But just at the moment when he thinks that he would feel the happiest, he suddenly has a deep sense of depression, emotional depression. And what Yadus, what the Torah is teaching us is that if it weren't for those two elements, again, I mean, it shows man that how powerful his need for self-importance is, that it has to be counteracted by two forces from two different spheres. One from the intellectual sphere, the recognition of the Alma Misa, and the second is on an even that would be overridden. Even that would be overridden. He'd forget about it. He could undergo a philosophical repression when it comes to that fact. But the one thing that keeps him in tune is the emotional, the day to day. There must be something that attacks, because the emotions are very short-sighted, and the emotions are overcome by the immediate. I mean, that's why, for instance, Kahelas starts off with Dor Holech V'Dor Ba. Why Dor Holech V'Dor Ba? What's the idea of Dor Holech V'Dor Ba? Dor Holech V'Dor Ba means that if you analyze a thing logically, intelligently, you have to know how much of it to grasp, okay? You can't, like Aristotle says, if you want to analyze the ocean, you can analyze one drop. That's true when it comes to analyzing the ocean. But when it comes to analyzing areas of knowledge, you have to know how much you to encompass, how much forms a unit to analyze, a unit of analysis. So the same thing is true in a sugya. When learning a sugya, so you can't just analyze. You could start the main. You could analyze the first word in the Mishnah and analyze the first Rashi and stay there forever. But that would be a very big mistake, because in order to analyze something, you have to know how much of the material do you have to grasp. That in order to have enough that lends itself for analysis. And the same thing is true of life. The fool's life is very short-sighted. He only analyzes, his analysis is limited to a very, very short span, the immediate. But Dor Holech V'Dor Ba is the span, the correct span, because that's the overview of, the correct overview of the topic of man is to look at what is the topic of man, what is one analyze man. It's generations. Dor Holech V'Dor Ba. That's the right point. That's the right point of analysis. That's the quantity, the proper quantity, that lends itself to an analysis of human existence. Not one day or one month or one year. It's the whole picture is the picture of man. Is what do you see in the way nature is constructed? That is a Dor Holech V'Dor Ba plan. That plan is implicit. That plan emerges from analysis, not from your emotions, your sense of the emotional. So the Chacham is the one that's able to remove himself from his emotions and to allow the subject matter to give the information. The proper information emerges from the analysis of the subject matter. And then once he has that information, then he can analyze. But the fool... The fool, the tipish, is the one, the chsil is the one that basically his determination of the span, that subject to analysis, is based on his emotions. The emotions are very tied to the immediate and to the small, very small world, which basically fades into oblivion very quickly, but his emotions are very attached to it. So his world of analysis, that's the difference in the chassil and the chacham. The chassil's world of analysis is determined by his attachments, his emotional investments, which are very, very small. What happened today in the news? What went on today? What's going on today? That's his world. His world is the world of the immediate and the present, which fades into nothingness over the years. But that doesn't prevent him from using that as the area of his analysis, because of the power of his emotions. So what counteracts that? The attachment to the immediate, that draw. What counteracts that is bitzachon. That's what the Torah says. That the current of depression, which accompanies his day-to-day attachments and is in the small world, that current of depression is what veers him away from, gives him an opportunity, I should say. It depends on the person's bechira, but it gives him an opportunity to move away from the force and the power of the immediate, because the emotions are always attached to the here and now, drawn to the immediate. The immediate is the world of the physical, the world of the psychological, is the immediate. A person enjoys himself, he enjoys himself in a small frame of time. So the attachment is always to the immediate and to the moment, and that causes a person to make a big mistake. The biggest mistake he makes because of that is his concept of happiness. His whole concept of happiness is based on his attachment to a small moment. That's why if you ask a person, what would he want, what does he want if he wants to be happy? What he really is thinking of is not a happiness based on a logical study of what happiness is. It's based on an experiential study. What is the experiential? There were moments in his life when he felt great, you see, and he attached to those moments. So happiness to him is taking those moments and imagining that those moments can be placed back to back throughout his life. You see, stretched out over his life. That's basically what he's looking for. Even in his search for happiness, the idea of happiness is a nonsensical idea. It's nothing more than taking a moment where he had immense pleasure, where the pleasure could depend on the person, pleasure and satisfaction with the self, or it is always tied in satisfaction with the self, but it depends on the individual, how his energies are dispersed, whatever it might be. But his concept and his search of happiness is based on his definition of happiness. And his definition of happiness is not based on any intellectual analysis, based upon ideas that emerge from the study itself. It's just based on the experiential. The experiential is the momentary, because the momentary is the experiential. So his idea of what happiness is a complete flaw. This very idea of happiness, a complete flaw. It's simply taking the idea of an experiential moment of great satisfaction and imagining that this could go on. If this feeling were constant, then he would be very happy. And, of course, even in a superficial analysis, the fact that experience is very high is based on the fact that it's momentary. If it weren't momentary, it wouldn't be high. But that's a logical analysis. So it's intrinsically impossible. The search that man is engaged in is an intrinsic impossibility, because it's based on an idea which is flawed, because his idea is an experiential one, that he had a great moment, and he would like to have always those great moments. But the only reason that moment was great was because the other moments were not great, and that's why that moment really was so packed with energy. But it's a virtual impossibility to have a succession of moments like that. So his search for what he calls happiness, what he thinks is happiness, is an intrinsic impossibility, and it's completely illogical. But it doesn't prevent him from that search, because the emotions are of the moment, and he gets fooled into thinking that the moment could be expanded. But the thing, the antidote to that powerful attraction to the moment is the bitzavon. The moment, the woman's maternal instinct is fulfilled at the moment of giving birth, and that would be something which, if it weren't for this, she'd be wrapped up into a great degree, a sense of self-worth. Because after all, what could give a person more of a self-worth than actual productivity? It's a powerful, powerful force. You see, the Nachash said to the Isha that the Yisim Kalikim, what does Rashi say, what Chazal say? Bari Alamos. So a woman really is a Bari Alamos in a sense. I mean, she's doing the act which is the most productive, producing human life. I mean, it's something that's done directly through her body. And that would be something which would take her into the sphere of her own self-importance and would be so self-absorbing that she would not be able to do anything else if it weren't for the fact that harbo arbe itzvonech veheronech, the tzavon that's accompanied by the heroyon, the etzev tel divonim, and then the leda is accompanied by a sense of depression, a sense of depression. So the depression is what counters the attachment of the energies in the moment. The Yoma Misa is an intellectual thing, which is also, of course, powerful. It's a quiet voice, but it's a powerful one because the reality of the mind recognizes it. But you need two types of forces, apparently. This is what Torah is establishing in Bereshit. You need two types of forces to counter the overpowering force of the need for self-importance. And those two forces are the Yoma Misa on the intellectual plane, and on the but the energies have a kind of a grabbing effect. They're grabbed by the moment. That the grab of the moment would be so powerful that the intellectual would not be able to have any effect. So the thing that stops the momentary draw is the emotional accompaniment of depression, the current of depression in man. You see, that accompanies all of his strivings and his accomplishments. His strivings and his accomplishments. So that is the antidote. So you need two different methods of giving man an opportunity for Bechira. So you see, really, like the Rambam says, what the loss of Adam was the moment he went down from his high station that he was at the time of creation, where he was a free intellectual spirit, able to simply engage himself in Chochmah and have no need for that sense of self-accomplishment. Then he wouldn't be Kare Tagar al Shivas Mei Breshis. There'd be nothing to be Kare. That would be a beautiful thing, Mei Breshis. He would only feel good thinking about it and seeing the Chachma. But now even the greatest Chacham, even the greatest cosmologist, when he studies it, is filled with a sense of remorse and sadness. And he can't escape it because of that institution which was placed in his mind. And that institution would basically swallow up man completely if it weren't for two things that counter it. One from the intellectual sphere, which is the Yoma Misa, and the other, which in spite of the Yoma Misa, the nature of the energies of man are that they're stuck and they get attached to the immediate. The attachment to the immediate is so powerful that the intellectual would simply have no effect, were it not for the emotional concomitant depression that is always there that weakens the attachment. That's Be'etzev Tel Divanim by the Isha, and by the man, his accomplishments are always accompanied with the Tzavon Tachalena, the Achila, and accompanied by the Tzavon, by the depression, that stems from a part of him that he's not ready for, he doesn't expect it, and he doesn't know it. But it is something that is always there. Those two elements protect him and guarantee and give him the ability for Bechira. But simultaneously, they guarantee that it is impossible for him to attain psychological happiness. That became impossible. After the Chet, that's a virtual impossibility, and that's basically Sefer Kalis. That's Sefer Kalis. And that's why the conclusion is Sof Davar Kol Nishma, like I mentioned before, Eselakim Yirav Es Mitzvosav Shemor. Kizek al Adam. It is sad, but it's not completely sad. What he's saying is that's the only satisfaction that a person can have. It's a rational satisfaction. Will it really satisfy his underlying need, his underlying psychological, that force in man for the Yisroel? The answer is no. But it gives him a satisfaction that if he studies and he knows that this is the reality of human life, so then there is a thin satisfaction, but it's also a strong one, that he's living in line with reality. This is the reality of man, and he's living in line with that reality. That's the only satisfaction. That's basically the conclusion. Okay. All right, boss. Okay, we'll stop it. Yes. No, it wouldn't be enough. No, because then the logical would spur him on. I'll get out of this. He would cast aside the Yitzhavon. The other, that's correct. Both, each one is necessary. Both on, they attack him from two different fronts, and each one is necessary.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Doesn't Kutz Nedardar operate also in this area?
Well, the Kutz Nedardar is part of the. Something. I'm talking about this. Let's not mix everything into everything. I'm talking about this one pasuk. Okay? All right. Okay, about that. Okay.
All
right. Okay, you too.
Take it off?
Okay.
Okay. This is my order. Okay. I just wanted to, the area we started last time, I think it was on a Friday last time. Right? Am I right? We did it on a Friday. So I just wanted to finish off some loose ends from what we did last time. But we mentioned the Kehelas, and it was just something I just wanted to show you about how accurate the Kehelas, the statement in Kehelas is that, and the way Chazal explained that that the Kehelas is against against Shivas Mebracious. So that how man is there's an interesting thing, by the way, that Chazal, I don't have the Chazal before me, but Chazal say that on each day they show why it's Havel Havolim. And on the Yom HaShabbos, it says, so the Medrash says, Yom HaShabbos, what is Hevel in the Yom HaShabbos? So it says, Mechaleh Mosimas. Strange. What does that have to do with the, why does that make it Havel Avolim? I mean, why does that make it Hevel? But according to the way we interpret it, what the Medrash is saying is very good. Because the Havel Avolim of Shlomo HaMelech is that man, when man looks at the universe, he has to say Havel Havolam. In other words, only Hashem could say Kitov. Vayah Hashem Kitov. That's because only God has an objective view of the universe. But man's view is always tainted. It's always tainted with his need for perceiving some kind of a purpose. And that's a part of his nature, and it's after the downfall of Adam. And once that's a part of his nature, so everything, that part of his nature really permeates everything that he does and that he views. And that's why when man looks at the universe, so man becomes despondent, you see. I just wanted to read you from, just to show you how true that is. There's a book that came out a while ago. It's called The First 3 Minutes by Steven Weinberg. By the way, if I mention a book, it doesn't mean that I recommend the book or that I agree with what the book says. I mean, it's insofar as physicists are concerned, their ideas when it comes to anything outside the immediate work that they do in physics, especially when it comes to the area of philosophy, is notoriously bad, very bad. It's like the Rambam explains that a person has expertise in one area. There's no transference, no carryover. But people always assume that there is a carryover. So I will get into something about that at another time. There's an important point that a person should know about this. But yes. I'll get back to that. I'll get back to that later. But what I want to show you is that, we're interpreting the Chazal, that a human being really can't have an objective view. And Vayad Hashem Kitov, only God can say Kitov. Man will always say Havel Avolam. So I just want to show you an amazing corroboration for this. That this book by Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize winner in physics, in the end of the book where he finally comes to what the ultimate prospects of the universe is, so he gives two possibilities. The possibility of eternal expansion or the possibility of that it will collapse upon itself. An open universe or a closed universe. So I just want to show you. So then he goes into, I'm not going to go into the details, but when he finally comes to the conclusion, I just want to read a few sentences to show you the way he thinks about it. He says, can we really carry this sad story all the way to its end, to a state of infinite temperature and density? Does time really have to stop some 3 minutes after the temperature reaches 1,000,000,000 degrees? Obviously, we cannot be sure. So he goes on to the uncertainties, but I'm not interested in the physics of what he's saying here. But just listen to the way he talks about it. He says, from these uncertainties, some cosmologists derive a sort of hope. You see, it may be that the universe will experience a kind of cosmic bounce and begin to re-expand. But then he goes to show that that's not too helpful either. So in the end, he says, however all these problems may be resolved, and whichever cosmological model proves correct, there is not much of comfort in any of this. It is almost irresistible for humans to believe that we have some special relation to the universe, that human life is not just a more or less farcical outcome of a chain of accidents reaching back to the first 3 minutes, but that we were somehow built in from the beginning. He says, as I write this, I happen to be in an airplane at 30,000 feet flying over Wyoming en route from San Francisco to Boston. Below, the earth looks very soft and comfortable, fluffy clouds here and there, snow turning pink as the sun sets, roads stretching straight across the country from one town to another. It is very hard to realize that this all is just a tiny part of an overwhelmingly hostile universe. It is even harder to realize that this present universe has evolved from an unspeakably unfamiliar early condition and faces a future extinction of endless cold or intolerable heat. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. And then he goes, he concludes very nicely, but if there is no solace in the fruits of our research, there is at least some consolation in the research itself. And then he goes on to say that human beings are not, men and women are not content to comfort themselves with tales of gods and giants, or to confine their thoughts to the daily affairs of life. They also build telescopes and satellites and accelerators and sit at their desks for endless hours working out the meaning of the data they gather. The effort to understand the universe is one of the very few things that lifts human life a little above the level of farce and gives it some of the grace of tragedy, which of course, he's moving in a correct way over there, which is Wayadis, the Tzelem Elokim. But I just want to show you how unavoidable it is, even for a person that is a top-rate scientist, to avoid what he's stating basically is, in the clearest terms, what Kahela says, that when man looks at the universe, he experiences a sadness. Why is he sad? He's not going to be here during that time. But it's hundreds of millions of years away. But the fact is that his view of the universe as a human being is tainted. And he cannot look at it objectively. It's unavoidable. No, it's impossible for man to do that. So, I mean, that's basically what Kahelis is saying. That was it, Dan Kahelis. That Vayad Hashem Kitov, only HaKadosh Baruch Hu could say Kitov. When man looks at the universe, he must feel Havel Avolam. Because that part of him that's tied to an idea of accomplishment. He distorts his view, and he's almost thrown into a kind of philosophical depression, you see, which shows basically that another point, which the Rambam always mentions, that a human being is, that's another reason why you have to be very careful. Another reason why a person must be very careful in accepting the words of experts when it comes to any of these areas. Because once you see that man has an emotional view, his view is tainted by emotion, which is part of his nature. So we have a Masorah, that the moment there's an emotion, the chance of arriving at truth becomes very slim. And one must really be a tremendous chacham to be able to sift out that which is true and which is real from that which is brought on by emotional thinking, which is a part of the nature of man that distorts reality. And I just wanted to show you that even the greatest physicists can't escape this fate. The only one, that's why we maintain that's why Maisa Bereishis is such a dangerous thing. Because the only one that could really enter into that realm is a person who is a true chacham and understands his emotions and can recognize them and know them and be able to know when an emotion is at play or when it's his mind, when it's his intelligence and his chachma. And that's why Chazal say that Maisa Bereishis is reserved for only the very, very few. Only the very few. And even in the area of the science itself, you can't trust the scientists. For instance, I'll just give you an example of something he says. He says, some cosmologists are philosophically attracted to the oscillating model. In other words, that the universe will collapse on itself. Especially because, like the steady-state model, it nicely avoids the problem of genesis. Okay? Because, you see, that is something which is the problem of genesis. It has nothing to do with physics. It has to do with philosophy, you see. And there is no real problem of genesis. It's only, that's a total mistake. One time maybe I'll just give a class on that to show you how this is a total error and has nothing to do with science, but has to do with philosophy. And it's a mistaken idea which stems from the fact that man, you see, a human being has the ability to be proficient in a science and yet not know the basis of the science. It's an amazing thing. A person can be a great mathematician. That doesn't mean he understands the foundations of mathematics. That's a completely different thing. As a matter of fact, the foundations of mathematics were not investigated even until the past century or two. So you could be an ingenious mathematician. And just like it's possible in Torah as well. A person could learn through, as Rav Chaim say, a person could learn through all the ins and outs of a sugya, know it perfectly, and not know what the basic idea of the sugya is all about. But that's true, and that's true insofar as learning is concerned also, that a person could be a great Talmud Chacham, and yet not understand the foundations of the thinking that is the basis of the limud. And similarly, a person can understand Torah Shebal Peh and Halacha very, very well and not understand the foundations of Yahadus. That is like the Rambam points out and the famous Rambam and Rivet. So you see that foundations is a completely different science. Completely different. So a person that's proficient in a science doesn't mean you should trust him when it comes to the foundations of his very science. As a matter of fact, Weinberg himself, in another one of his books, states that the whole foundations of the quantum are very shaky. They don't really understand it. Doesn't mean that they can't make discoveries. Doesn't mean they can't. They doesn't mean they can't intellectually continue to penetrate further. It's a different science. It's a different mitzvah. Different science. Foundations of a science are not the same thing as the science itself. It's a different kind of a science. And that's why, that's why a person has to be very, very leery because people are generally taken in And they think if a person is a great scientist, they start trusting him. You can't even trust the individual when it comes to the foundations of the very subject that he is a master in, because that's a different type of a mastery. Okay, a person can have a great intuition, for instance, in giving good definitions. It doesn't mean he could define a definition, what a definition is. It's a different kind of a thing. So that's why in our Masorah, you have to be very, very careful. And that's why Chazal were very cautious when it came to these areas, because people tend to be taken in by the fact that a person is a great mind in a subject. Might be a great mind in a subject. In his area, it could be very great. But there's no spillover into the areas that are even the foundations of the things that he is doing himself. So I'll speak about it another time. But anyways, what I wanted to show you was how true the words of Kelis are. And therefore, even when it comes to a cosmologist, you have to know that they themselves are moda, that there are very powerful emotions in these areas, and they're guided, the human beings, they're guided by emotions. So you really can't trust. You can't trust them. But the only thing, what it takes is a very great chacham who understands the foundations of Yahadus and the ideas and the correct ideas, and who also is on a level, as I said, that understands the ideas pertaining to man and the nature of man, and who knows how to differentiate between man as an emotional creature, and to identify the emotions and to know where his mind is working and where his emotions are working. That's a different kind of a different kind of a science. That's not physics anymore. So. But what I wanted to just show you was how amazingly accurate the statement of Kehelis is, that the Havel Havolim. That's exactly what Kehelis meant by the Havel Havolim. Okay. I wanted to So what is the idea of the of Shabbos? That Shabbos is a wonderful day, but nevertheless, Mechaleh Mos Yomos. You see, what I think the Chazal mean by that is again that you see, what does Mechaleh Mos Yomos have to do with it? The Mefarshim try recognize the difficulty, but I think the answer is that the Yom HaShabbos is an unbelievable day. But simultaneously, the fact that the person knows that he's constrained to keep it takes away from the enjoyment of it. You see, in other words, the element of that, and that is something that that is something which is a which it's impossible for the person to avoid. That is, when I say impossible, I don't mean totally impossible. I mean impossible for man on the Kehelis framework. Kehelis, in the Kehelis framework, he's discussing man insofar as he's a psychological creature. You see, he's not discussing a person that has risen above human psychology, like Moshe Rabbeinu became a Sechel Nifra. He's discussing man qua Adam. So, insofar as man is a psychological creature, that's what Chazal is saying. That the Yom HaShabbos, it would seem, is perfect. Yeah, but there's one problem. He knows Mechaleh Mos Yomos, and that detracts from the element of his nature, which is what psychologists call the superego, is going to give him a source of pain over here, because he knows Mechaleh Mos Yomos. He has to do it. You see. So that's what Kehelis is saying, that this element of man permeates every aspect of his existence, and it affects him in every area, and even something which is the Yom HaShvi'i, which is the most perfect day, but it will creep in even to that, in that day, and will take away from the real Shvi'i, of the real Yom HaShvi'i, you see. Okay. What I wanted to do was... I wanted to just go in a little more into what we started with the Isha, with the curse given to the Isha, and then to the Adam, and then to the other. But certain things that we could draw from this. I wanted to just mention the Rambam in the Rambam in the Mora, where the Rambam says, "I haven't got the regular one." Okay. Yeah, so the Rambam says like this. The Rambam says that he quotes certain Chazal over here. And the Rambam says, this is it's on Genesis, it's chapter 30 in the book 2. It's on page 217 in the paperback guide. Okay. Yeah. So the Rambam says that the ideas of the ideas with regard to Adam and Chava are the deepest ideas, and he says that they really can't be understood. The ones that open up these ideas are Chazal. And he quotes some of these midrashim. You see, and he says like this. He says, but he very, he's, in his usual way, he's very cryptic. He says, yeah. This one, I don't want to take all of this. I'll take part of it. Yeah. He says like this. He quotes a lot of Chazal about Samuel. The measure of Samuel, the serpent had a rider. The rider was as big as a camel, and it was the rider that enticed Eve. The rider was Samuel. Okay, and he goes into that. I just want to show what he's showing is that some of these Chazal. He says it more clearly over here. He says the following. He says like this. The greatest hatred exists between the serpent and Eve, and between his seed and her seed. Her seed being undoubtedly also the seed of man. More remarkable still is the way in which the serpent is joined to Eve. By the way, I want to tell you, his translation is terrible. Friedlander does not understand the Mara. That I could tell you. He has no understanding of the ideas in the Mara. And his translation is really bad. In some places, it's horrible. Throws you completely off. Sometimes when I look back at the original, I wonder how we even did it. Translate. That's strange. But anyways, he says like this. So the Rambam wrote in the letter, he can't trust the translator who just translates words, doesn't understand the ideas. And he says like this. He says, Eve defeats the serpent by crushing its head, while the serpent defeats her by wounding her heel. This is likewise clear. The following is also a remarkable passage, most absurd in its literal sense, but as an allegory contains wonderful wisdom and fully agrees with real facts, as will be found by those who understand all the chapters of this treatise. When the serpent came to Eve, he infected her with poison. The Israelites who stood at Mount Sinai removed that poison. Idolaters who did not stand at Mount Sinai have not got rid of it. Note this likewise. Again, they said, the tree of life extends over an area of 500 years journey, and it is from beneath it that all the waters of the creation sprang forth. And they added the explanation that this measure referred to the thickness of its body and not to the extent of its branches. For they continue thus, not the extent of the branches thereof, but the stem thereof has a thickness of 500 years journey. This is now sufficiently clear. Okay. Again, God has never, this is an amazing chazal, God has never shown the tree of knowledge of good and evil to man, nor will he ever show it. This is correct, for it must be so according to, and here's the wrong translation, it should be according to nature. He has according to the nature of the universe, it has nothing to do with that. They're completely wrong. Okay, what I want to show you is that the thing is that the Rambam goes on, and he mentions more Chazal, and he always says it's clear and it's true. I mean, okay, he doesn't want to really explain it, obviously, to Ram. But what I want to what I want to say, and you know, you're not allowed to give an explanation for the Rambam. You know that. The Rambam wrote in his Hakdama. You're not allowed to give any explanation. There's no such thing as a pirush. If you see a pirush of the Mora, you know right away it has to be wrong. Because the Rambam made an isser on explaining anything in the Mora that he didn't explain. You're only allowed to explain things that he quotes from other sources, but you're not allowed to explain anything that he says himself originally. Okay, what we can say from the Mara is one thing is clear from the Rambam and the Mara, and that is that the ideas of the Eitz Hadas and the early account of Adam really is the thing that unravels it is really the Midrashim. And it's you have to be careful in how you interpret, and it's certainly not the pshuto kamashmo, but the main ideas are beneath the surface. Okay, that's a famous chazal that he's quoting, the chazal about Maimed Har Sinai, that Hitil Bozuama, that the Nochosh implanted in the Isha a kind of poison, and Har Sinai, those that stood at Har Sinai, the Zuamo was removed, and those that didn't, it wasn't removed. Yeah, just to make a first step in the direction of the explanation of that Chazal, and what is the basic idea that Chazal is saying? The basic idea that Chazal is saying is that Maimad Har Sinai was not just an intellectual affect. It wasn't just that we gained tremendous knowledge at Sinai, but it also had an emotional impact that had to do with affecting human nature for those that were present and for all succeeding generations who accepted the heirs to that event. You see, that's really what Chazal is saying on the most basic level. That's what Chazal is saying, and Maimad Har Sinai had a powerful emotional effect, and the powerful emotional effect has to do with something, has to do with the state of man that was with the Ishan and the Nachash and the Hitil Bozuama and the other nations that weren't at Har Sinai, they didn't have this effect. But that's the basic idea of the Medrash. And Maimad Har Sinai had an emotional impact, and the emotional impact was a good one, because what it did was, in the most basic terms, the effect of Sinai was to subdue the instinctual force to a degree. See, just the effect of Sinai. That's what Chazal is saying. That the inskus samoil, and what the Rambam is saying, and the hitil bazuama has to do with the instinctual. It means that the nachash, the relationship of the nachash and the isha was an instinctual, sexual kind of a phenomenon. It was tied very tight to the instinct. And that Maimad Har Sinai, just being at Maimad Har Sinai, had an emotional effect that subdued the instinctual in a certain way. That's what it means, that Klal Yisrael that were at Har Sinai, they don't have the Zuama. The Zuama is a reference to the activity and force and power of the instinctual. And the Nachash enticed the Isha. The Nochas enticed the Isha, you see, and that enticement was something that affected and gave her a certain arousal. That arousal was an instinctual arousal, and Maimad Har Sinai subdued it. Just the effect of being at Sinai, at seeing the event of Sinai, and all the succeeding generations that accepted Sinai. You see, that's the meaning of the Chazal. Okay, it's like the Rambam says. See, there's one thing I will take from the Rambam. and I don't think the Rambam would be upset with it. And that is where he says that the Chazal that are most absurd in its literal sense is an allegory that contains wonderful wisdom and fully agrees with real facts. That's what the Rambam says. Fully agrees with real facts. Okay. So that's the key. What the Rambam is saying is the key to understanding Maisa Bereishis, insofar as a person is capable, has to do with understanding real facts. If it gives you insight into real facts, then you know that you're on the right path. If it doesn't, then obviously you're not. So this is what the meaning of the Chazal is on a basic plane. Okay. There's one thing that's very interesting, and I think it's significant in the same sphere, and that is the Nachash. Okay. Really, what was the curse of the Nachash? The curse of the Nachash was al gechon chaselah. Correct. Kiyasisos aruatam mikol abeimo mikol chayas asoda al gechon chaselech viyofar toch al kol yimei chayecha. So what kind of a what's the difference if the animal goes on its slides on its stomach or if it has legs? I mean, what is the difference between that? Rashi's raglayim hoyilov and iskatzitzu. Yeah. But Rashi really hits it on the head. That what is the you see va'ata tushufenu okev. So Rashi says lo yeheloch koma. You see, koma, height. So what it means is that apparently part of the attraction of the nachash to the isha was the fact that the nachash had height. The nachash had height, and height is an attractive feature. You see, even today people say he's tall. You see, he's tall. So tallness is an attraction. So apparently the attraction of the nachash, or an essential ingredient in his attraction to Chava, was the fact that he had height. He had koma. So he had koma, as Rashi points out. So al gechon chaselech removed one of the attractive features of the nachash, his height. Okay. So you see, even in you see by Shaul HaMelech, what was the pasuk mentions? Mishichmo v'mala gavoh mikol ha'am. It was very tall, very tall. Tallness is an attractive feature. By Shaul. It says by Shaul. Mishichmo v'mala. Yeah. Who did I say? Shalom, I'm sorry. Shaul. So height is an attraction. So the thing is, what does it mean that the nachash lost his height? That's how gechon chaselech is the opposite of height. It means he had no height. Okay, he went to the opposite extreme. He had no height. So what is the significance? What difference does it make if the nachash really today's nachash? If the nachash would have height or if he wouldn't have height, what difference does it make? I mean, in today's, that's the next question that you're going to be bothered with. What's the difference if the nachash? So today's nachash, would it make a difference if he had legs or he didn't have legs? What is the purpose? You see? What's the answer? See, the fate of the nachash, and that's why the Rambam mentions these Maimori Chazal, because the fate of the nachash was that it was to be the incident was to be obliterated from the memory of mankind. See, that's the fate. You understand? That is the fate. The incident of the Nachash and Chava was to be completely removed from the mental memory of man. See, that's what Chazal was saying. The curse for the Isha and the Adam was different. That had to do with the nature of Adam and the nature of Chava, you see. But the Nachash, the idea of the Nachash and the curse to the Nachash really is not so much whether the Nachash walks on his legs or whether the Nachash travels on his stomach. You see, but what Chazal is saying, what the Torah is saying, is that it had to be removed from the memory of mankind, the incident and the attraction, so the Nachash could not remain in his original form. What it means is that would be bringing to mind, that would bring to Adam's mind the whole attraction of the Nachash. So it was removed from man, was thrown into a part of his history that was forgotten history of mankind. That's basically what the pasuk is saying. Okay. Yeah. That's essentially the difference between, you see, and the Hu Yishufcha Rosh Va'ata Teshufenu Okev. Hu Yishufcha Rosh Va'ata Teshufenu Okev is also a reference to that idea that there is an attack against the instinctual, which is a direct frontal attack, you see. But then there's a counterattack, which is hidden. Ata teshufenu okev. Okev means concealed, which is a description of the Yetzer Hara. Man attacks the Yetzer Hara, Rosh, but he doesn't really get down to the underlying source of the attack. Ata teshufenu okev. And really what the Torah is dealing with in this area has to do very much with, of course, it's factual, and the account it's factual, but the ideas that are the realities, that like the Rambam mentions, are the ideas of that the ideas that exist in the human mind. Okay, the ideas exist in your mind. I'm not going to pursue it too much over here. I'm just trying to give you an approach, a way of understanding it. But that the fate of the Nachash is completely different. The fate of the Nachash is vis-a-vis Chava. You see, that's what it says, Ve'eva Oshis Bein Chav Ein Oisha. It's vis-a-vis Chava. It's not the Nachash, not for the Nachash. Nachash is gone, that's it. There was a Nachash, there was such a creature that was a combination of intelligence and instinct, and he ceases to exist. But it's not that he only ceases to exist, but that the encounter was erased in the memory of mankind, from the memory of mankind, and there's a reason for that. Okay, so now what I wanted to do was I wanted to just go through the, with regard to the Isha. Now, what does the Pasuk say with regard to the Isha? So the Pasuk says, Vayomar Hashem, So what I'm trying to point out is that the curse to the Nachash is a different kind of a thing and must be understood in its essences in terms of how, and that's why Chazal say, Hitul Bazuhama, you see. So the essence of the curse of the Nachash is insofar as how it affected Adam, not insofar as the Nachash himself is concerned. Okay, but the curse to the Isha and the Adam are intrinsic, essential. Are essential, yes.
So the curse is that man could not relate
to events. There's a big difference. Okay, psychological events have a certain impact. It's a different. There's a difference between psychological events and between ordinary events. That's the difference.
So that's and psychological.
That absolutely.
And
that's right.
Relate to that psychology.
And that's right. And no one. And that is completely erased. It's completely erased. That's why you see Chazal say that the Zuhama of the Nachash was removed at Har Sinai. What does that mean? Does that mean that a person that stood at Har Sinai knew that? I mean, no, it doesn't mean. It means the Chazal had to tell us that. You see. But the experience was there, which means that at Sinai, a certain element of the instinctual, which was aroused by the Nachash, was put down, was subdued. The event, the awesomeness of the event of Sinai, you see. But these are, of course, just what I'm trying to do here is not so much to bring out specific ideas, but just to give you a framework of what the Torah is teaching us in terms of, you might say, like Rashi Prakim, you know what I mean, like just headings, You see, so it means to say, I mean, just to put it a little bit more in practical terms, what it means to say was that at that time, if the Nachash, if that did not happen to the Nachash, then Adam and Chava would not be able to erase the psychological impact of the event of the Nachash from their minds, and it would continue down through history. So the fact that the Nachash lost his height and his attraction made Chava forget, so to speak, the exact nature of the attractiveness. And if that wouldn't have happened, then she would have seen the Nachash, and she couldn't, and it would have aroused it. And then it would be repeated in the succeeding generations. But this was necessary in order for Adam and Chava to erase the psychological effect. And once it was erased, it was lost from mankind. That's what I mean by these events are primary events. And these are events that have to do with the structure of Adam. It's not ordinary events that we would experience, because it was events at the time of the formation of the mind of Adam. And that's why they have a different kind of a character. And that's why you can't just undo these things. No matter how great a person is, he can't undo these. You say, why do I have to be cursed because of Adam? Because these events are unique. They're events that have to do with the structure of the mind of Adam, which was, from that point on, going to be carried on. So these events have a different kind of an impact. But that's why the Nachash had to lose its coma, its attractiveness, because otherwise Adam and Chava would still relate to it, and it wouldn't be forgotten. But since the attractiveness was gone, so when they saw the Nachash shifted, it simply had no value. And that's why the memory of the event was erased. But that's basically what the Torah is teaching insofar as the Nachash. What I want to show you is that the ideas of the Nachash are ideas that don't make any sense unless you understand what they revolve around and what their aim and objective is in the framework of the events. You see, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give you the framework of the events and to show you how they make sense when you have the right framework. I'm not pursuing it into further detail. I'm just trying to give an overview of how to understand it and how to, and this time, I mean, for further insight, but I'm just trying to lay down the basic framework. You understand what I'm saying? Okay.
And how does Zina fit in there? Because if the curse got rid of it, then what is
Zina doing? No. For further analysis, you have to understand that these things are not simple things, because you're dealing with powerful forces. So certain things that the event is forgotten, it doesn't mean forgotten like it's completely gone. See, it doesn't. That's not what it means. That in psychological material, doesn't work that way. You don't just forget something and it's gone. You forget it, and by forgetting it, you lose its effect in a certain sphere. Doesn't mean the effect is completely gone. You see, that's why, in order to understand this area of the Torah, you have to understand the basic framework of human psychology. You see, of how it works. So these are different kind of events, not ordinary events. Okay, an ordinary event that you forget, that's it. But over here it means, yes, it's true that man could not continue if the attraction of the Nachash were as it was before. He wouldn't be able to continue. It had to be forgotten. Does it mean that because it's forgotten, it doesn't have any affect? It doesn't play any role in it? No, that's not true either. It does. And that's what Chazal say. Sinai undoes it. I'm not going into a detailed analysis and specific over here at this time. What I'm just trying to do is to try to show you a way of thinking about it and to understand how the words of the Torah make sense and the importance of what the Torah is trying to convey. I'm trying to give you a basic framework without... I mean, we can go at a later time and go into certain details and into what a more precision and more elaboration and more understanding and what it means and ways that these things are manifested. But right now, I'm just talking in abstract and general terms to understand what is the Torah teaching us with the idea of the Nachash. That's the basic. But that's the basic idea. That's the basic concept. It's very similar to what the Chazal of the Rambam mentions has certainly that meaning. I'm not trying to explain what the Rambam's saying, but the Chazal that he mentions that Adam, that God never showed Adam the Eitz Hadas, nor will he ever. What does that mean? You see? So you see that Chazal are telling you that to the Eitz Hadas as a tree, yes, that Adam saw. But the Eitz Hadas, in terms of what it means in human psychology, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu never showed him, nor will he ever show him. Okay, doesn't say he can't discover things himself, but it says God will never show him that. You see, doesn't mean he can't discover things. Doesn't mean that no human being can have knowledge of it. Doesn't say that. It says God will never show it to him. You see. Apparently, what the idea is that it was left to the realm of his bechira to be able to continue and to ponder and to try to understand. And if he's zocha to understand it, he can gain great insight. But for God to give him that insight would remove his whole realm of bechira. It's very important to know that there's a big difference between something that a human being does by way of knowledge and pursuit of knowledge and truth and what is given to him before. There's a big difference between those things. See? What's given to him before is received in a different kind of a way. You see, what a person gains through insight and knowledge is received in a different way. It's a different kind of a knowledge. You see, that's what Chazal mean. That the knowledge of the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra was never given, God never showed Adam, and he never will. See? Doesn't say that Adam, that man can never gain knowledge. No, he could, but then it's a different kind of a phenomenon. If he gains the knowledge and uncovers certain things about himself, that's different. Then if HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives it to him, it's a different kind of human existence. It's a different result. There's a difference in the result of whether a person attains knowledge through investigation and pursuit of chachma, or whether God simply initially gives him that knowledge. That's a different kind of an Adam. Okay? It's different. Okay? The source makes a big difference. Okay? So, at any rate, to get down to more, let's see, that's what I just wanted to show you, the framework of understanding the Nachash and the Chazal, with the famous Chazal with the Maamar HaSinai. Okay. And to understand what the Torah is telling us about the Nachash and Al-Gachon HaSelech, what the idea over there is. Yes.
You mentioned that Nachash is an actual creature.
Yes.
How does that tie in with the rest of Rambam and the story?
Because that's what I want, that's what I spoke about. I gave a share on that once before. That everybody runs into metaphor. You know, it's nice to escape into metaphor, but that's not the way to learn the Torah. And I think when I gave this year, I showed that the Nachash, that the Rishonim take the Nachash literally. It's literally, I spoke about it at that time. Doesn't mean, you see, literally does not mean there aren't deep ideas behind it. Very deep ideas behind it. But people that can't understand it, they don't understand what took place and how those ideas emanate from the events, so they try to escape into metaphor. Yeah, but you can't do that with the Torah. That's what the Ramban says. That was Ramban's criticism of the Rambam in Vayera. Ramban's criticism was because he didn't understand the root of the Rambam. So he says, yes, and then you'll just say Kola Torah Kula. That's Megala Panama Torah. Shalok Halacha. I mean, you just take the Torah and say that it's all a metaphor. So you'd be very careful of it. They're very careful. So that's why I gave a shir on the Nachash. And that's why I explained why the Nachash is literal, but what the ideas behind it are. They're remarkable ideas. It doesn't take away. But that doesn't mean the Medrash is not correct either. They're both. It's like the Ibn Ezra says. When you understand the Medrash, you understand the Mikra and the Medrash and how it naturally flows and is combined, and that's a different, that's the real science of Torah. But you understand? I mean, that's I spoke about that last time. Yes. Yeah, entirely different.
He's different.
Trees,
there's no intelligence and there's no walking.
That's correct. That's correct.
Pretty much like a creature.
It would be a creature.
The only relationship that you have is the reference in the Torah that whatever creature it was now crawls on its belly, which is what we have right now.
That's correct. Yeah, but that's what I'm telling you, what the significance of that is. That's exactly what I'm trying to explain right now. What the significance is of this nachash that we have today, in contradistinction to the nachash as he was originally. But the significance of the original nachash I mentioned is something which basically anthropologists have been searching for centuries, for generations, which is a creature that has a higher intelligence than the highest level of animal intelligence, because there's a tremendous gap there. And why does animal intelligence stop at a certain level? I said that was the nachash. The nachash was really according. They are right in the sense that according to nature, there should be a continuity, and there should be a higher level of animal intelligence. And the Torah is saying there was, and that was in the form of the nachash. So it has a deep meaning in terms of ideas and in terms of showing Maisa Bereishis, that Maisa Bereishis originally was more complete. It was more complete, but there had to be changes. You see, but originally it was more, and the anthropologists that are searching for a missing link are right. They are right. They're onto something, that it should continue like that. But the Torah explains with the Nachash exactly why it couldn't be that way. But excuse me.
They're looking for an ape, not a snake.
An ape. Look, I mean, these things are. It comes to conjecture, and I mean, that's. Get into the realm of imagination. I just tell you what the Torah is explaining. Okay, so now what I want to say is like this: that I think that was abandoned, that idea. There's a lot of problems with those things, with the porpoise and the none of these things is aware of. But anyways, separate story. Now, so let's just take Elishama Har Bar Beitzvonech Veironech Beetzef Tel Divon. Okay. Yeah, so we mentioned that that there's a difference between the word etzev and between the word tsar. And etzev means depression. Etzev means depression. Like Rashi says later, vayis atzev alibo. Rashi says, what is the pasuk quotes? Nisabel, Zavelos. Rashi says, Yitzatzev al Libo, in the end of Bereshis. Nisabel al Ovdon Maise Yodov. Kimo Nis Netzav Hamelach al Beno. Netzav Hamelach al Beno. He's depressed. Okay? Well, you have Velo Atzavo Oviv Miyam of Lema Madua Kacha Asisa. That David Melach never rebuked his son. That was Adoniyah ben Chagas. So he never rebuked him. What does it mean? That's v'lo atzovo. Because when a person is rebuked, he's depressed. Becomes depressed. So David HaMelech failed to rebuke him, and that's why he was arrogant and wanted to take over the melucha. So atzovo means etzev means. So even though Tirgum says tsar, you have to understand the Tirgum. And Rashi says tsar gidul banam, but you have to understand where, you know, things aren't just always the same. The pain is, Rashi's telling you what the physical component is, but he's not denying that the word of be'etzev means depression. Okay, but then he's showing you what the physical phenomenon is that causes this psychological thing. So it's not over here. Etzev doesn't mean simply pain. It means depression. So Okay, the heronich. Tsar or Ibur, and of course it means the menstrual cycle and the psychological depressions that a woman goes through because of her biological nature. Okay? But then it says, El Ishech Chukosech. Okay? And then it says, Vehu Yemshobach. Okay? Yeah. So I just wanted to explain what it means, what those two phrases are. Velishech chu kasech. So one is depression. So it means that both suffer the same fate. That depression was to counter the effects of the component of his conscience or superego, is more precise, that developed in him. Okay, so the depression counters that. We explained that the depression counters it because it removes on the spot the attachment, whereas the misa, the yoma misa, removes philosophically. It is a philosophical attack on the on man's megalomaniac pursuits. Okay, the part of man that gets him into his egoistic drives. Okay, his super egoistic drives. So we explained that. Yeah. So that both have, but the difference is by the isha it says valishech chukasech. Okay. Now what does mean valishech chukasech? That she has a chuka for her husband, right? Yeah, okay, but it's but the husband has a chukka for her too. I mean, so what is the significance of this? And then the Hulim Shalbach. Okay. I believe that what Torah is describing here is in psychological terms. See, vel ishech chukka. That's what Chazal say. That's what the Rav was mentioning about chazakas. He says you can't when Chazal say there's certain chazakas. That Tavla Mesef Tandu, these are things that are from Sheish to Mebracious, and you can't just talk them away. You can't change them. You can't change them. You can't, as the Rav said, you can't tamper with the Chazakas of Chazal, because they're based on ideas of the creation and the nature of man. So that that's why the Rav said that a woman alone is a sadder, is a much sadder phenomenon than a man alone, you see. But what does that mean? And that's the lishech chukasech. Lishech chukasech means, doesn't mean that she has a desire for the man, because that's true. The man has a desire for the woman. They both have equally desire. What it means is that the woman has a certain dissatisfaction with herself that she fulfills in having a husband, and having a man. That's what it means. It means that she has a certain sense of dissatisfaction about herself. That's vel ishech shukasech. It's not a reference to the attraction between the sexes, because that's mutual. But it's a reference to an inner feeling, an inner psychological phenomenon, that she feels a certain lack of completeness, and she finds it in the identification in the relationship with her husband. You see, she finds that satisfaction. That's what Chazal say, that Yose Mima Sheho Ish Rotzalinase, her Isha Rotzalinase. That's what Chazal say. A woman has a greater need. And that's really expressed, that idea is expressed over here. Now, these ideas are underlying ideas of human nature, and you can't just make a take a poll. I mean, because you can't just make a study of it, because you have to know exactly what you're looking for and exactly how it's expressed. And there are many disguises for these things, but the underlying, what the Torah is telling you, the underlying root idea, and apparently it's significant for man to have this knowledge, because I mean that's why the Torah is telling you. But that's what it means. Valishech shukasech. It means that there's a certain unhappiness that she has about herself that she fulfills through her husband that makes her feel complete, makes her feel a certain sense of completion in a different way than a man has a satisfaction out of having a wife. That's something different. This is an internal sense of a lack, okay, which is, that's v'lishech chukasech. Okay, now what's v'hu yimshalbach? Okay, a lot of people want to know that. Yeah. So v'hu yimshel bach does not mean that the man will run the household. Okay, that, it does not mean that. Okay, doesn't mean the man is boss. That's not what it means. You see, what? Because we see that that's a rarity. Yeah. So what does v'hu yimshel bach? V'hu yimshel bach means that the what it means is that apparently what the Torah is telling us here is an interesting thing. And when you study Bereishis, it's very difficult because we're after the fact. In other words, today we look at our own nature. It's very hard to imagine what our nature was. I mean, you can't, because everything in your nature, when you study nature, you look at your emotions, and your emotions are of the present. And anything that's otherwise sounds contradictory, and you aren't prone to think in those terms, you see. But it would appear from the Torah. And that's why I said last time, I said it's hard for us to imagine, but it would appear from the Torah that the woman would really is the one that would take off completely with self-adoration, because she's like a creator, because she actually with her own body produces a human being. It's difficult for us to imagine what the force of such a thing would be on the human psyche, because it doesn't exist anymore today. But from the Torah, it would appear that that would be the most powerful force. And that's why, because that is really like a Maisa Bereishis. I know Chazal said, three shutfim badam. So it means that insofar as man is concerned, this is the most powerful thing. But that, you don't see, women don't experience that anymore. And that's because it's after the way the Bria was changed. See, the way the Bria was changed. Be'etzef tel divonim, harbor arbets vonech, ve'eronech, all these things, the depressive factor, the depressive element has kind of wiped out that counter, because I mean that was the plan that HaKadosh Baruch Hu implemented in the Bria, and the plan works. So it's hard for us to go backwards. But from the Torah itself, you see that apparently is something which is a psychological force that we today can have no concept of it, but logically you can perceive it. It would be the most powerful force of being overwhelmed by the self, you see. So, but apparently also something else. It would appear that woman's nature originally was aggressive, you see. That's why it says, what the Pasuk say, that Vatitain gam le'isha ima vayochal. She was active, you see, in that event. Vatitain gam le'isha ima vayochal. I was supposed to say that Vatikach mipir vatochal, vatitain gam le'isha ima vayochal. So apparently the woman before was active, aggressive, you see. But Vahu Yimshol Bach means that her instincts were converted into the passive. You see? That's Vahu Yimshol Bach. That's why Chazal say that a woman is a woman has more shame. She's not as forward. She's not as forward. That's the nature of woman. But that is because of the conversion. But apparently, originally, she wasn't that way. Originally, she partook of the active just as much as Adam. There's no difference, you see. And then the Pasuk Vatitain shows you that she simply gave it to him. She was aggressive about it. So, Vahu Yimshol Bach means that her instincts were now changed and became essentially, not completely, essentially, into the passive role. But that's why I said it doesn't mean that she rules the household necessarily. It doesn't mean that she's the boss, because through the passive, you can exert a tremendous influence. The ultimate influence, not talking about who rules, it's talking about who Yimshol Bach in terms of the instinct is not an instinct of ruling. It's a passive instinct. So apparently it would appear also that from the Torah you can deduce that originally the woman was aggressive, just like the man. Just like the man. Okay. Yes?
The conversion. Was this part of the...
Sure. Okay. Let me finish it a little bit. Maybe make it clear. So apparently in order... But this again, what does this show? This again shows you something that's very difficult for us to comprehend, because again, we're after the... We're after all this, so it's hard for us to imagine. But apparently, if it wasn't converted into the passive, you see, that then again shows you the power of the Leda. The power of the of Leda is so so powerful that it was necessary to remedy that potential downfall had to be remedied with a few institutions, that it was not just the depression, but besides that, it was the Elishech Chukaseich, okay, a certain sense of lack of feeling of completeness, which she derives from her husband, from the man, and also the passivity. The passivity changed the course, and that was necessary apparently also in order to counter the institution that was created to remedy the situation of following the Tavo Ilainayim, the lustful instinctual. So the institution of the conscience, or more correctly as of the superego, had to be countered, and the passivity was another idea, was another element that grounded the woman. Because of the powerful force of childbearing, it's an interesting psukim. It really is an uncovering of the force of an instinct that you can't sense anymore, but you see the Torah is telling you all the changes that had to take place, which obviously shows you how powerful that force was originally, and of course is, but it's kind of deactivated. But in the study of man and understanding man, it's very significant, of course, even today, because that's the purpose of all of the whole account, is to give insight into the nature of man, because, like the Rambam says, there are realities today. And a careful and accurate study and understanding, I'm not doing that now, as I said, I'm just giving you the framework. But a careful analysis will have very important effect, not only on the woman, but on the man too. I mean, it's not just the individual. You're talking about Adam and Chava, so you're talking about man. So there are certain things that an understanding of the woman is helpful for the man just as much as for the woman, because it has to do with the human nature. It has to do with human nature. Not totally devoid. It's not totally. Man is not totally devoid from the instincts of a woman, and vice versa. You see, and there are ways where these things are expressed. I mean, I mean, Leda is, for instance, Leda, the idea of Leda. The idea of Leda has to do with creativity as well, has to do with intellectual creativity. And therefore the effects, when the Torah gives you an understanding of the of Leda in an Isha, it has repercussion, has value, not just in the actual biological process of Leda, it has a value in the higher spheres of man as well. Because if you understand it by the way of knowledge, it has tremendous significance in the whole panorama of the human psyche. You see, I mean, it's not limited. It's a lack of insight to just look at these psukim and just say this one was cursed. I mean, that's not what the Torah is really trying to teach you. So there's the idea of the power, the powerful force of Leda can be expressed in a man also. I mean, in architecture, man creates, he produces. That is a sphere of Leda. A sphere of Leda has to do. There's Leda, the biological Leda, but then there's Leda in the psychological sphere, which that's why what I'm trying to show you is that the ideas that the Torah teaches us are significant in the framework of the knowledge of the human mind. That's really why the Torah gives us the account. So you realize these things aren't limited. They're very, very pervasive. Very pervasive. Yes?
regard to like the component of the depression, that would seem to be an addition of an additional item to counteract certain emotional drive.
Right.
But the other one, in terms of changing from aggressive to passive, that seems like literally changing the entire nature, as opposed to adding an additional component to counteract something.
That's a qualitative. You mean that's a qualitative change?
Well, what I mean is
that's a qualitative change.
No, in other words, with the first one, you could say there's still the underlying emotion. The only thing is the addition of the depressive aspect.
Countermeasure.
And theoretically, if somebody didn't have that component of depression, that drive would still be there.
Yeah.
Whereas the other one seems like originally they had this aggressive nature, and
abrogation.
Then it was changed to a passive nature. So there is no idea of, well, now if they didn't have this other thing, that drive would be there.
And once more. One more time. Yeah. That is working in man today. It is because the value of the insight that is working in man, every one of these things is working in man today, and not just in the Isha and the Ish, but it works in both of them. But it's giving you the origin. Of how the origin and the essence of where it results. I mean, there's a lot of facets to it, but it's essentially when it says the way the Torah is telling me, for instance, in the Isha, that's an essential phenomenon. It's an essential phenomenon, but there are outcrops of that that have to do with Adam as well. That have to do. You have to understand the idea over here. You understand what I'm saying? But if your question is to put the picture together, I mean, that is definitely a noble endeavor, to put the picture together let's take the Isha first, put the picture together by the Isha. So what do you have by the Isha? How many things do you have? You have one is, the first thing is the depression, and that we said is equal to man. The next thing is a sense of lack of completeness about the self, which he didn't have before. Apparently, Chava before was very happy with herself. She didn't have any complaints. So that was the second thing. And the third thing was that the change from the aggressive to the passive. I mean, again, it doesn't mean completely removed. It means that in a significant way, that the instinct travels through a passive course, essentially. It doesn't mean she can't be aggressive. It means that essentially its mode is passive. Its mode is passive. That's true.
But
that's
the
correct.
Underlying drive is really aggressive. That's what I was saying.
No, the energy. Let me put it this way. It's a conversion. Okay, it's a conversion. In other words, the when you say aggressive, a lot of these terms are very bad because aggressive has a certain kind of connotation, which is not correct. A lot of the problem is when you're trying to deal with precision in understanding any area and the psychology as well, you make use of words that have side connotations that are not correct. Okay, I would say instead of aggression, I would say the energy in man is always to move forward. That's the impulse to move forward. So there are two courses. You could move forward in a aggressive force, you might say. Again, aggression is not a good. You might say, okay, but I have another word. Or in a passive, in an active or passive way. Active is not exactly right either. But you understand what I'm saying? In other words, a person, it's like the Rambam says, If a person didn't have courage, he wouldn't get off the bed. What does he mean? He means that courage, you don't have to have courage to get off your bed. Not what we mean by courage. He means there is in man the nature to move forward, to make use of his energies. And if he didn't have that, and courage has to do with that same force to move forward. So the energy always wants to move forward. So, and if you didn't have any of that, you wouldn't get off your bed because, you see, so the when we say aggressive, we mean the energy that is active and that makes a person move from one place to another in his psychological world, that energy can be worked out in two ways, either through an active aggressive form or through a passive form. In the woman, it's relegated to the passive. But she moves forward through the passive. But it's a different expression. It's a different expression. Okay? It's a qualitatively different expression. So apparently, but one thing you see from the isha, and that's why I said why it's very hard to analyze it, is because it's not something that we have feelings about today anymore. But the logics of it is the way that we can perceive, can understand it. So apparently it means that this creativity that she biologically was endowed with was such a powerful force that it had to be countered on several fronts. And it shows you, and the Torah simply describes each front. So one front was the depression front. Now what does the depression front do? The depression works in a way that it detaches one from the thing. That's what depression does. See, when a person, depression makes a person is very ambitious and they want to accomplish something, then they get depressed. What does the depression say to them? Forget about it. I'm finished with this thing. See, it detaches. The element of depression is a detacher, so to speak. Detaches you from what you're into. You see? That's the nature of that thing. The sense of Elishech Chukosech is a different attack on being involved with the self as a great creator. You see? And what is that? That is a lack of a sense of completeness about oneself. That's a different way of countering that same force. Do you understand? That's a different way. That's a countering through the self. Okay? Because if you're not satisfied with yourself, you feel a lack, that counters the overwhelming involvement with the self, qua self. Do you understand? It's two different methods. It's completely different methods. You understand what I'm saying? Okay.
It's an internal and an external.
One is, in the case of depression, what depression does is simply detaches you from what you're involved with. You're involved in building worlds, and now you get depressed about it. I'm finished with this. Goodbye. That's one kind of attack. The other kind is an attack on the becoming overwhelmed with the self as a creator. If the self feels that it's lacking, that counters it from the self point. Okay? And the third way is the passive. The passive is the character of the way you move ahead. If it's memshala and melucha, that is one train, that's one way to go, you see, which the character partakes of being overwhelmed with the self as a creator, because creator is active. It has a creator is active. You see, so the way it was countered by the Isha was on every possible front. Every possible front. In other words, in terms of the detachment of the energy, that's the Etzev. In terms of the feeling of self, which is the objective to be overwhelmed with the self as a creator, the self sensed a sense of lacking, you see. And the third way was that the channel was a channel of passivity. And that's not the character of creator. You see, creator is active. So the character of the thing was changed. So you see the complete picture that emerges from the fate that Chava suffered. You see, the fate was one which, because of the overwhelming power of her position, it was countered on three fronts. On three fronts. Okay? You follow? But it is a complete picture.
What was the counterpart for man?
Excuse me?
You mentioned that also with man, there were also
changes. You mean, yeah, well, I didn't get that yet.
Oh.
I just want to complete this. But you see, yeah, okay. Okay, again, what I want to emphasize is that the limud is not just a limud for the isha, but the limud is for the adam as well. I mean, I'm just reminded of a statement that Albert Einstein one time made. He said that we're always very involved, or we give a very high estimate to our work and to the work that we do. You know, each person, whatever he does, he gives a tremendous, like, this is the greatest thing, you know, whatever the person is involved with. And I don't remember, he goes through a few possibilities as to why it is that we feel that way. So is it because some of us may really are in more important things, like a scientist or different things? In the end, he concludes, he tries a few, I don't remember, I read it a long time ago, but I remember he tries this, he tries that. In the end, he says, no, it remains a great mystery, why we give so much value to what we do, you see. But it's true. It is a great mystery, and that's why the Torah addresses it, because the creative element in man is not in not just a woman, but in a man as well. You see, but in the man, it's not what the Torah is saying is that if it were attached to the biological function, it would be impossible to overcome because the instinctual resides in the biological. That's where its essence is. But like I said before, it doesn't mean that the idea is not applicable to a man as well. I said, for instance, Leda. In the Leda, there's creativity in man is you getting into that same realm. And therefore, the ideas that the Torah speaks about and how to counter those things are significant, not just in terms of the history of the events as they unravel in the Torah in the original biological sphere, but they have great importance, great significance, insofar as man is concerned, in the intellectual sphere and in the psychological sphere and in the whole realm of the psyche. You see, that's why it's important to notice to understand the ideas and to see how it works. That the countering of the overwhelming satisfaction or desire for satisfaction with the self is countered in man on basically the way the Torah describes it by the Isha is on three fronts, in terms of the attachment. Breaking the attachment, in terms of a sense of a lack insofar as the self is concerned. The Isha has it on a biological level, but Adam has it too. Adam has that too. When man senses a lack of completeness in the self, that counters just as much. It counters in our world, it counters that self-satisfaction that the individual is looking for. And the third sphere as well, that man is passive also. Adam is passive as a passive element on a higher sphere, as a passive. As a matter of fact, I mean, the Kol HaTorah Kula is that a person recognizes God's will, which throws him into passivity, So the passive, the ideas that the Torah explains in the Isha have relevance not just to the Isha. That is the root of the source of these forces. But these psychological forces exist in all of Adam, in all of man, and they have very important effects in the life of the psyche, for both individuals. For the woman, it wasn't the primary biological that it took place, but the ideas exist insofar as Adam in the higher, more sublimated spheres as well, in the sublimated spheres. And they're very important to have a knowledge of the ideas. And the three forces basically that counter the desire for man to be involved with himself and the emotion and the desire for self satisfaction with the self. Okay. I'll go a little further. Okay. I will stop here in the meantime. Okay. Mention over here last week. It was a little vague, but okay. So what we mentioned was the... we didn't really go into any specifics, which made it a little vague. I mean, what I tried to set down was a foundation. Okay, foundation's always hard. So, yeah. So the thing is, though, that we mentioned that the foundation's hard because you don't really, it's hard to see what you have there. I mean, if somebody wants a house, you show them a foundation, not so happy. So I'd like to just show, in order to bring out the idea of the foundation, I'd like to show you a concept here. It's a possibility, and serves two functions. That number one, to bring out the idea of the foundation over here. That we said that the nachash was an event that Chava was attracted to the nachash, and Agachon Chaselech was a removal of the attraction. And it was done so that there were no memory traces of the event, in the sense of an active memory, a memory that has a value in the person's life. You can remember something, but if it has no emotional value, so it doesn't really matter in terms of your emotional life. It's just a fact. So we said that her attraction to the nachash had to be completely obliterated. So Gachon Chaselech removed the attraction of the nachash, and it was completely forgotten. So and Chazal say, we mentioned a Chazal that Chazal say that Hitl Bazuama, and those that stood at Sinai, so the Zuama was removed. And the other nations that didn't witness Maimar HaSinai weren't heirs to the event of Sinai, so it remained. So it's kind of like a riddle, in other words. What was it? What was it that was a very powerful attraction? That attraction was so powerful that it had to be completely erased and removed from memory, and yet apparently something remained that Sinai corrected. That's really what we were saying yesterday, last week in the parsha. That there was some event that took place, that it was a very powerful event, emotionally very powerful, and it had to do with the attraction, the Isha's attraction to the Nachash, and that's why his koma is, when it says his koma was removed, it means that that was his prominence, his attractiveness was removed, Agachon Chaselech, and nevertheless, Hitul Bazuma, something remained from that event, even though it was erased, but something remained, and Sinai corrected it. That's what the, when you put together the whole picture, I mean that's what the Torah is telling us. It's a strange riddle. So we just left it last week, like in a and just drawing the lines of what the Torah is telling us, without really coming to any kind of a concrete idea. So what I wanted to even though, I mean, you know, to me, the main thing is the foundation. But the idea, I'm going to propose an idea as to what this possibly could mean, the event of the Nachash, and which will explain all the aspects of what this... this so-called this riddle is composed of. You see, the thing is that the question is, what was this powerful attraction? Like the Medrash says, the Rambam quotes the Medrash that it was Samoil was riding on the Nachash. It wasn't the Nachash himself, it was Samoil. What I think it means is like this, that it's talking about the Isha was engaged in the desire for satisfaction. And that's clear from the way the Pasuk describes her view of the Eitz Hadas. And that it was something which was, it was Nechmod Lamara, Tov Eitz Lamachol, Savo Hilainayim. Nechmod Eitz Lahaskil. What I think it means is that you see, in human psychology, a person is after psychological satisfaction, whatever the person does. But in order for the person to achieve psychological satisfaction, the person has to go through processes, and they have to do things, and in those things they find the psychological satisfaction. But ultimately, the bottom line is a certain psychological feeling, a certain psychological satisfaction. That's the bottom line of whatever any human being does. So, what the Isha saw in the Nachash was the attraction of attaining psychological satisfaction, you see, without engaging reality. In other words, to accomplish the goal of satisfaction, but bypassing the events that a person has to do in order to attain them. Do you follow what I mean? You see. So that kind of a phenomenon is something which would be a disaster for man. If man would try to make his goal just that, you see, then he would be completely devoid of reality. If that's what man's objective was. So in life, it doesn't work that way for us. In life, a person is very attached to events and to particulars in order to attain the goal of psychological satisfaction. But the events are the things that come to his mind when he's trying to obtain his goal. He loses sight of the satisfaction itself. But if a person would put himself to simply the goal of the satisfaction itself, removed from any kind of reality, you see, then he would be destroyed. So then he would be totally in the world of fantasy. So that's what, you see, that's what the Nachash represented for the Isha. The attraction to the Nachash was an attraction to bypass all the necessary particulars in order to attain satisfaction and to go directly for the satisfaction. Yes?
Is not the child magical thinking something akin to that? The child goes through...
Yeah, it's true. The child is much better at that. But even the child is always attached to some kind of a physical reality, whether it's the mother's love, or whatever it might be, or the food, or whatever the instinctual drive is. But it's always attached to something which gives it that engaging in that something gives it the satisfaction. But and in a grown human being as well, if a person wants to feel good, so a person has to go out and be successful or do things that they feel are successful, or even in the physical world. What a human being is after is really psychological satisfaction. When a person eats, he doesn't have the same desire as an animal. A dog eats because the instinctual gratification is what it is, what it goes after. But in man, when a person eats, he really wants a certain psychological sense. As a matter of fact, I mean, that's why the Rambam mentions in the Hakdama to the Shemona Prakim that you can't equate the desire of a human being. You can't equate the desire of a human being with the desire of an animal. Even though they all have desire, and insofar as man is concerned, he's an instinctual being, but he's completely different because there's a psychological element there. So his goal, even in the mundane and even in the instinctual itself, it always is for a certain psychological kind of satisfaction. The particular that he may employ in any instinctual gratification, there are different particulars he may employ. But the end goal is always a sense of psychological satisfaction, not a sense of instinctual gratification. So even if a person sits down to a meal, what he really wants is not what an animal is after, you see, which is simply the physical response, the physical neurological response. In man, it's a psychological thing that he's after. If he wants to have a meal, he wants to enjoy himself, so there is a certain, what his goal is, a certain kind of psychological phenomenon that to him makes him feel good. That's why a person doesn't eat like an animal. A person dines. He has a very elaborate kind of an involvement. It's completely different. Whole world of the whole culinary world. I mean, it's a different kind of a thing, because man is a psychological being, and for him to eat. Festivities, most of the things that he has, most of what he's involved in, is really in order to attain a certain psychological sense when he's finished. He's after a certain psychological sense. So he needs an elaborate kind of setting. He needs to feel the environment is good, the table is set right, all the accoutrements and all the side things that are necessary in order for him to feel happy, to make him feel good, so that his eating wine and his food and the way it's set out and all the elaborations are what make him totally distinct from the animal world. That it's not simply a physical satisfaction that an animal has, as the Rambam says in Hakdama in the first paragraph of the Shemona Prakim. That even though man has instincts and an animal has instincts, they're totally different, because man is of a different nature. So in man, what a person is looking for is a certain psychological satisfaction at the end of the road of all his strivings. What he's striving, the strivings are aimed at a certain psychological entity, which makes him feel good. That's man's goal. It's totally distinct from the animal. So the thing is, in order to attain that psychological goal, in whatever he does, whether it's in a profession, whether in all of his endeavors, it's always the psychological element. The psychologist is really right, because the psychologist says that all the things that people are after, whether it's money, whether it's prestige, whether whatever it might be, it's all one thing. In the end, the bottom line is always a psychological sense of satisfaction. That's why for one person could be extremely happy living in a way where another person would look down at it and say, this life is terrible. Because it has to do with the person's psychological goals and his ends and the way they're structured psychologically, that what one person will think would be a great day, one person will go into business and spend 15 hours in business, and for him this is a day, another person will look at that as a horror. So the psychologist is right in that if you really want to look into the essence of a human's life, what you have to look for is an understanding of the psychological, because that the bottom line is that's what a person is after. It's not money, it's not success, it's not whatever it might be in any sphere. The bottom line is the psychological satisfaction. But if a person would be able to attain psychological satisfaction spontaneously and bypass all these processes, you see, that would be detrimental. Because then the individual would never engage in any kind of pursuit in reality, you see. He would never engage in it. He would simply, if a person could take a pill that would give him total psychological satisfaction and bypass all the processes, he wouldn't do anything. He would simply, he wouldn't have to have an elaborate meal. He wouldn't have to achieve any goals in life. He would simply get to the end of the line very quickly. And the end of the line is simply the this kind of a satisfaction, you see. So the what I'm proposing is that that was the ultimate attraction of the Nachash. The ultimate attraction that Chava saw was, that's why the Torah gives that vivid description, was to get to the end of the line of the psychological satisfaction through this Eitz Hadas. Nechmod Savo Leinayim Nechmod Eitz Lahaskil. So it is something that will achieve the goal and the desire without going through all the processes that a person has to go through in this existence in order to attain psychological satisfaction. You see, in today's world, you find it. In today's world, that is basically the goal of drugs. That's the goal of drugs. The goal of drugs is simply to do that, to accomplish that, to get to the end of the line without going through any kind of intermediary steps, you see. So what the Nachash, that's why Chazal say it wasn't the Nachash, it was the rider. It means to say it was the end, that which is at the end of the line of the cycle, of the process. The end of the line of the process is ultimately, no matter what pursuit a person takes on in their life, the end goal is simply that psychological satisfaction. So the Torah said that this kind of, that was the attraction of the Nachash. And the Isha, when she engaged the Nachash, that's what came to her mind. And that had to be erased. Because if a person would have that state of mind, the attraction to the end goal would be so powerful that they'd never be able to take any intermediary steps, any kind of intermediary steps. So Al Gachon Choselech means the attraction of the Nachash, that memory trace, so to speak, had to be removed forever, you see, so that man will never venture through that path anymore. It really is the most intelligent path when you think about it logically. Why should I go through all the difficulties if what do I have at the end of the line? What do I have? A certain psychological state of satisfaction. So all these things are just a waste of time. But man, you see, man forgot about that. And man simply doesn't think about that. He looks for the satisfaction, but he must always look for activities and performances and involvements and pursuits and strivings. He always must take that course, you see. That the reason why he must take that course is because of the fact that memory trace, so to speak, of Chava's attraction was completely obliterated from human memory. And therefore he doesn't choose that path anymore. Now he chooses the path through reality. How does he goes after psychological satisfactions, but the path is through a very, very circuitous course, and a course that in the long run we can't evaluate objectively, and it might not even be worth it. You see, but he has no choice, because his instincts are fixed to attaining the psychological satisfaction through the course. You see. So he can't even evaluate it. That's the question, yeah.
You do see that druggies, heroin addicts, and fapids do, once they are engaged in that activity, aside from the addictive feature of those things, would they continue to go after that in that fashion?
They do. As a matter of fact, many psychologists know that there's two types of addiction. There's addiction which is a physical addiction, but then there's addiction which is psychological addiction, which means